Welcome to The Deep Dive, the only show that takes your stack of sources, your notes, and your research, and really delivers the most critical, surprising, and actionable intelligence from the world of U.S. federal activity. I'm Alice Johnson, your guide.
And I'm Sam Kennedy, and I'm ready to connect the dots on what was truly one of the most intense, strategically synchronized 24-hour news cycles we've seen all year. This is the Federal News Update for Saturday, November 22nd, 2025.
Our mission today is, well, it's exhaustive. We are diving deep into the comprehensive and really granular record of what the U.S. federal government has been doing just since the beginning of Friday, November 21st.
Yeah.
And what we saw unfold yesterday, it wasn't just a busy Friday. It was a profound set of structural changes, escalating enforcement, and some really high-stakes judicial moves all happening in concert.
That synchronization, that's the key takeaway, isn't it? The sheer volume and the coordination of it all. I mean, you've got the deconstruction of a cabinet department, a massive interior immigration offensive, and these immediate strategic shifts in defense planning. It suggests the administration's deconstruction agenda is no longer just, you know, a political talking point.
It's operational.
It has achieved operational maturation. This is a deliberate, active process of bypassing Congress completely through what you'd call administrative fiat.
Mm.
They're using the tools of the executive branch to reshape the architecture of government at an incredible speed.
Okay, so let's unpack this blueprint. Let's start with what is, I think, arguably the biggest structural bombshell of the day.
It has to be.
The shocking and really sudden operational dismantling of the Department of Education. I mean, this is an agency that's the nexus for billions in federal aid, research, civil rights enforcement.
And this action, which just unfolded so rapidly on Friday, it's a textbook case. It's a case study in using the bureaucratic toolset to achieve a political goal that would, you know, just fail miserably in the legislature.
Right.
The administration didn't even try to repeal the Department of Education Organization Act. Instead, they basically achieved the department's functional demise by using six distinct legally binding interagency agreements, or IAAs.
So instead of going through the, you know, the complex, visible, politically messy process of passing a new law, they used administrative contracts, agreements that are really just meant for internal resource sharing.
Exactly.
And they used them to effectively hollow out and scatter an entire cabinet agency. What was the administration's public rationale for a move that aggressive?
Well, Secretary McMahon framed it as achieving efficiency and, quote, returning education to the states. The argument was that the department was bloated and ineffective.
Okay.
The legal premise behind it, which is already under challenge, by the way, is that the executive branch has this really broad discretion over how programs and offices are administered, how they're managed, reorganized.
So they're basically saying they can manage the department into non-existence, even if the law that created it is still on the books.
That's the argument. But the immediate legal and political backlash was, I mean, it was swift.
Instantaneous, I'd imagine.
Completely. National groups like the NEA and the AFT, they condemned the plan as illegal and lawless. Their argument is that these actions violate the fundamental statutory design of the Department of Education Organization Act.
Because that act specifically mandates the existence of these offices.
It does. The critics are pointing out that you can't simply contract away core statutorily mandated government functions through these little administrative agreements. The scope is just way beyond what an IAAA is for.
And this is where that philosophical shift becomes really palpable. And I think this is crucial for you, the listener, to grasp. The biggest move here, the most consequential one, is transferring the Office of Elementary and Secondary Education, OESE.
The core of K-12 support.
Exactly. Moving it directly to the Department of Labor, the DOL.
This is so much more than just shuffling boxes on an org chart. This transfer signals a profound administration-wide rethinking of the purpose of public education itself.
How so?
By putting K-12 oversight in the Department of Labor, the administration is explicitly treating primary education as, well, a function of workforce preparation and economic utility.
So education isn't about civic development or academic exploration anymore?
Not primarily. It views students first and foremost as kind of labor inputs that are necessary to meet market demand.
The practical consequences of that could be huge for school districts. I mean, things like curriculum choices, especially in areas that aren't seen as essential for workforce readiness, like arts funding, social studies, even humanities.
They could all see pressure or even defunding, as the new oversight agency, the DOL, prioritizes vocational and STEM outcomes above everything else.
That's the fear.
That is absolutely the concern. The whole metric of success shifts from, you know, academic growth to immediate employment. And the sheer scope of the programs they transferred is just astonishing. We aren't talking about small grants here.
No, this is the bedrock.
This is the bedrock of federal education support. We really need to get granular on the list of programs now under DOL oversight, because the implications for school districts everywhere are just immense.
Okay, let's dedicate some time to that exhaustive list.
Okay, so this list, it represents billions in critical grant money and compliance infrastructure that now has to deal with a completely different federal bureaucracy. Under the DOL now, you have Title I, Part A,
which is the huge funding stream for low-income children.
Right. And putting school poverty alleviation under a labor market framework, it fundamentally changes how you'd even approach the problem. It frames poor educational outcomes as a labor market problem, not a resource one.
Okay.
Well,
Title Y, Part B. These are the state assessment grants. Standardized testing. Now, the Department of Labor will design and oversee the metrics of academic success, presumably to make sure they align with, you know, economic readiness standards.
So testing for jobs, essentially.
In a way. Then there's Title I, Part C for migratory children, and Title I, Part D for neglected, delinquent, or at-risk youth. This moves youth rehab away from educators and social workers and puts it in the hands of labor officials.
Likely prioritizing job training over, say, therapeutic interventions.
That's the worry. Then you have Title II, Part A. This affects teacher training. The DOL will now dictate the standards for effective instruction, treating teachers like managed labor inputs.
Wow.
Title III for English language acquisition is now seen through the lens of workforce integration. Title IV. Part A, the block grants for well-rounded education. That flexibility is expected to shrink.
And the after-school programs.
That's Title IV, Part B, the 21st Century Community Learning Centers. Critics worry they'll be retooled as just basic childcare for working parents and lose the enrichment goals. And finally, Title V, the rural education program, now subject to DOL metrics.
This sounds like a logistical nightmare in the short term. The sources we're looking at cite state education chiefs saying this plan actually increases bureaucracy.
Massively.
Some are estimating a five-fold spike in complexity, which just completely contradicts the administration's whole rationale of cutting red tape.
That is the immediate, undeniable contradiction. They claim to reduce bureaucracy, but they create this huge, immediate friction for state agencies that now have to completely rework their compliance systems to deal with the Department of Labor.
And that could cause real cash flow crises for districts waiting on their grant money.
Absolutely. It could delay essential services for months during this transition.
And beyond OESE, this whole dismantling caused what you called a diaspora of specialized services, scattering them all over the government.
It did. The fragmentation is a huge concern. First, Indian education programs were moved to the Department of the Interior, the DOI.
Okay.
And while DOI already houses the Bureau of Indian Education, critics worry this just reinforces segregation, isolating indigenous education from broader national academic standards.
And the move with international programs, that have to be driven by a very clear national security focus.
Exactly. International education programs like Fulbright Hayes, they got transferred to the Department of State. The stated reason was explicitly to conform these academic exchanges with national security and foreign policy goals.
Which suggests a pretty deep and overt politicization of academic freedom.
It does. And finally, the CCAMP IS program, Child Care Access Means Parents in School, was moved to Health and Human Services, HHS. This treats on-campus childcare for low-income student parents as just a social service, not as an essential educational support that actually helps boost college retention rates.
So we get to this hollow shell paradox. What is actually left of the Department of Education?
It's basically reduced to a massive financial institution, the Office of Federal Student Aid, or FSA.
The entity that manages the $1.6 trillion federal student loan portfolio.
Exactly. And keeping it there is purely logistical. The FSA infrastructure is just immensely complex. Trying to move it with an IAA would risk a systemic collapse of the entire federal repayment system. So the department now exists as this zombie agency. It's a loan bank and accreditation enforcer, but its core programmatic and pedagogical functions are just gone.
And what happened to its regulatory and enforcement arm, specifically the Office for Civil Rights, OCR?
They starved it of oxygen. Earlier in the week, 315 staff were fired. and the targeting was disproportionately against the OCR.
So it's a deliberate strategy.
It's a deliberate tactical strategy to effectively nullify federal oversight of discrimination in schools, whether it's based on race, gender, disability, without ever having to formally repeal the civil rights laws themselves. The department's ability to investigate claims is now just severely compromised.
The human consequence of this kind of structural violence can't be overstated. We're hearing about career employees facing forced exit or reassignment to agencies where their decades of expertise are basically useless.
The reports paint a picture of just profound despair. The hostile rhetoric, you know, calling the agency a bureaucracy that needs to be broken, it created an intolerable environment.
Right.
The most poignant anecdote I saw in the sources: during Secretary McMahon's announcement to the staff detailing this dismantlement, not one person applauded.
Wow.
That silence, it just signifies this deep-seated professional and moral alienation among the career civil servants who were just told their life's work was being functionally dissolved.
That brings us pretty neatly, actually, to the broader federal workforce picture. Let's turn to the IRS and its own structural assessment, which was happening at the same time as the ED dismantling.
Right. So while ED is being functionally dissolved, the IRS is facing its own intense structural realignment. It's focused on capability building and modernization. The IRS Chief Information Officer, Kashit Pandya, directed IT staff to complete a mandatory technical skills assessment.
So technical skills assessment, why now? What triggered that, and how is it different from just a performance review?
Well, it follows significant workforce instability. The IRS has lost over 2,000 IT employees. That's more than 25% of that workforce since January, partly due to these voluntary separation incentives they offered.
So they're trying to figure out who's left and what they can do.
Exactly. Pandya was quick to emphasize this 90-minute assessment is a technical baseline assessment. It's about skills like coding and engineering. Mm-hmm. It is not a performance rating. And he said it will not affect an employee's pay or grade. The goal is to establish an objective baseline to align the workforce with their modernization goals.
And what's the long-term strategy here, especially when it comes to contractors?
This whole push is really being driven by Treasury CIO Sam Korkos. Mm. He's been very critical, arguing the IRS IT workforce just lacked the skills for modernization. He once said publicly that too many people in the engineering function are not engineers. Yeah. So the long-term goal is to shift reliance away from these high-cost, temporary, external contractors. They have 4,500 of them versus only 6,000 full-time employees, and move toward a more capable, resilient, and frankly, cheaper full-time federal IT workforce.
And this assessment is the first step.
It's the foundational step to identify the skills they need to hire or retrain. It started small, with about 100 employees in really technical roles like AI engineers, and it's rapidly expanding.
And speaking of workforce fallout, we also got definitive closure on the fate of thousands of RAF notices, the reduction in force notices, that were issued during the recent government shutdown.
This is a small piece of good news in all the chaos. More than 3,600 federal workers who got RAF notices during or right after the shutdown have now had those notices formally rescinded.
And that reversal was explicitly mandated by Congress in the continuing resolution, right?
Exactly. Provisions in the CR that reopened the government specifically voided any RIF notices issued on or after October 1st. And the Justice Department filings on Friday argued this legislative action basically makes the union lawsuit over the RIFs moot. Congress fixed the problem.
But, and this links right back to the structural changes we just talked about, there's a critical exception to this reversal that hits the Education Department.
Yes, this is the catch. The fate of 299 positions in the Department of Education's Civil Rights Division remains grimly uncertain.
Why are they different?
The administration's legal counsel argues that these specific RIF notices were initially issued much earlier, back in March of 2025, so they are not covered by the CR provision that reversed the shutdown-related RAFs.
So while most of the shutdown RIFs are gone, this specific group in the already targeted OCR still faces involuntary separation.
Compounding the damage to that enforcement arm, yes.
Okay, let's pivot now from internal bureaucracy and workforce issues to the strategic posture of the defense industrial base and long-term security planning. This part of the story reveals massive capital investments and a real focus on energy resilience.
Yeah, the transition is thematic. You're moving from reorganizing internal assets to projecting strategic power through technology.
We start with the Army's ambitious new venture, the Nuclear Microreactor Initiative, also known as Project Janus.
Right. So the Army issued a solicitation through the Defense Innovation Unit for Janus. They announced firm plans to use commercially based small nuclear reactors to power critical military infrastructure.
And the main driver here is energy resilience.
It's all about energy resilience and security. They're responding to frequent electrical outages, increasing power demands for things like advanced computing, and just the limited backup options they have, especially at these remote, strategically vital locations in the Arctic and the Pacific.
So what's the concrete timeline and scope for this program?
The Army plans to test this technology at 9 separate bases between now and 2030. They have a hard goal of having at least one operational domestic microreactor deployed by 2028. This fits perfectly with the administration's broader energy goals.
Dr. Jeff Waxman offered a key perspective on the main challenge here, which is cost effectiveness. He said parity with fossil fuels isn't always necessary, but the Army needs to define, quote, how much we are willing to pay for resiliency.
And that is the core economic debate. Waxman pointed out that in high-cost places, like a remote base in Hawaii or Alaska, where power can cost 40 cents per kilowatt hour, a microreactor is already competitive.
The price of reliability is already high there.
It is. But for the Janus program to really scale up, the Army needs to establish its definitive resiliency price, the premium it will pay over fossil fuels to guarantee uninterrupted power during a conflict or a natural disaster.
But the Army's role here is bigger than just being a customer. They're actively trying to reshape the entire U.S. nuclear industry.
Oh, absolutely. This is a massive strategic market intervention. Waxman noted that the U.S. nuclear industry right now is basically a dozen startups, each with its own proprietary design, completely different supply chains. That's not efficient.
No.
So the Army aims to influence the market by helping to, in his words, squeeze multiple startup designs into similar supply chains, moving away from these expensive one-off custom handmade components toward a more standardized mass production model.
And this ties into a critical workforce development model, too. The Army is explicitly trying to emulate the NASA COTS program, the program that famously created SpaceX to attract new talent.
The COTS analogy is perfect. The goal is to make nuclear sexy again. By providing these guaranteed long-term contracts and stimulating innovation, they hope to fix a decades-old engineering talent shortage in the nuclear field.
Using the defense imperative as a catalyst.
Exactly, to draw top young engineering talent back into a sector that has been lagging for years.
Moving from energy resilience to financial relief for service members, we also saw the introduction of some sweeping new tax legislation.
Yeah, the Service Members Tax Relief Act, introduced by Senators Ricketts and Hamaday, is extremely broad. It seeks to exempt all active duty and reserve pay, plus any bonuses, from federal income tax.
That is a colossal measure. It goes way beyond the existing military tax exemptions.
It does. I mean, current law already exempts combat zone pay, allowances for housing and food, and veteran disability pay. Those exemptions already amount to about $30 billion a year in lost revenue. This new proposal is magnitudes bigger.
So the fiscal debate around this was immediate. The sponsors call it fiscally conservative relief, but experts like Andrew Lautz challenged that.
And strongly. Lautz's argument is really straightforward. Whether you call it a tax cut or new spending, any huge financial measure that isn't offset by spending cuts or other tax increases is fiscally irresponsible. It just adds directly to the deficit.
So a measure costing tens of billions annually without a way to pay for it is a tough sell.
A very tough sell. It also is important to note that service members would still have to pay payroll taxes on that income. The bill only addresses the federal income tax.
Meanwhile, the newest military branch, the Space Force, is finalizing its long-term strategic plans.
Right. Chief of Space Operations General Chance Saltzman announced that the Space Force is wrapping up its 15-year strategic roadmap, which they're calling the Objective Force Design. The final work is expected by the end of 2025, with a public release in early 2026.
This sounds like a master plan for the next generation of space warfare. What does it actually cover?
It's very comprehensive. The document outlines the specific systems, infrastructure, and manpower they need between now and 2040. Crucially, it maps out which current systems need to be sustained, which need to be phased out, and which new capabilities need to be brought online fast.
So its main purpose is to provide stability and predictability for the industrial base.
Exactly. It's meant to be a stable, comprehensive demand signal to everyone involved. Congress for funding, defense contractors for R&D, and our allies. Saltzman wants this roadmap to eliminate the stop-start funding cycles that plague long-term planning. It will be a living document, updated annually.
Okay, let's wrap up our security section with the Coast Guard's really notable policy reversal on hate symbols.
Yeah, this was a very rapid course correction. Late Thursday and into Friday, the Coast Guard released a new, much firmer policy. This came after a huge outcry when it was revealed their internal draft plan was to describe swastikas and nooses as merely potentially divisive.
That initial softened language prompted sharp condemnation. People feared it was a quiet rollback of anti-bigotry protections.
It prompted serious political pressure from groups like the Anti-Defamation League and lawmakers like Senator Jackie Rosen. So the new revised policy is unequivocal. It says divisive or hate symbols and flags are prohibited, and it explicitly lists a noose, a swastika, and any symbols or flags co-opted or adopted by hate-based groups.
And the admiral in charge claimed it was all a misunderstanding.
Admiral Kevin Lunde was adamant that the symbols were always prohibited, even during the drafting of that softer policy. He called reports of relaxing prohibitions categorically false, but the optics forced this quick, hard clarification.
And this policy update is happening in a broader context, right? Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth ordered a review of all military hazing and harassment definitions, arguing they were overly broad.
That's the critical context. The initial softened language of potentially divisive was seen as aligning with that broader rhetoric from the secretary's office, which is why the backlash was so forceful. The final, stricter policy now aligns the Coast Guard with the firm directives across the rest of the Pentagon.
Okay, let's segue now from the military apparatus to the intense, coordinated interior enforcement actions from the Department of Homeland Security. This section details a serious escalation we're calling the Interior Immigration Offensive.
Yeah, we saw three aggressive simultaneous actions targeting politically sensitive jurisdictions in just 24 hours. They used both regulatory maneuvers and tactical deployments.
Starting with this unprecedented move targeting temporary protected status, the Minnesota directive.
Late Friday evening, the president announced via social media the immediate termination of temporary protected status, TPS, specifically for Somali migrants who are living in Minnesota.
That is legally and politically extraordinary. TPS is a humanitarian designation applied to all nationals of a certain country. It's not typically targeted by U.S. state.
Exactly. This is unprecedented, targeting a TPS group based only on their state of residence. The president tried to justify it by alleging, with no verifiable evidence, that Minnesota had become a hub of fraudulent money laundering and that Somali gangs are terrorizing the people. He explicitly linked the decision to political opposition, attacking Governor Walz and Representative Ilhan Omar.
So what is the immediate legal vulnerability of an immediate termination announced on social media?
It is highly vulnerable to a court challenge. The federal statute is very clear. DHS has to publish a notice in the Federal Register at least 60 days before terminating any TPS designation.
60 days.
The president's attempt to just bypass this statutory non-negotiable notice period makes the directive highly susceptible to an immediate injunction from a federal court.
But the humanitarian impact is immediate, regardless of what happens in court weeks or months from now.
The fear is instant and it's destabilizing. While the nationwide number of Somali TPS holders is small, only around 700 people, Minnesota is home to the largest Somali diaspora in the U.S. This announcement created immediate fear and uncertainty across the whole community.
Next, DHS confirmed it's redeploying these highly militarized Border Patrol Tactical Units, BORTAC, to New Orleans for something called Operation Swamp Sweep.
This is a major tactical and operational escalation in interior enforcement. The operation is scheduled to start around December 1st. And critically, DHS secured the Naval Air Station Joint Reserve Base in New Orleans as a staging ground.
Why is that significant?
That move allows the BORTAC units to operate independently of local civilian infrastructure and, crucially, bypass any local sanctuary restrictions or agreements that might limit where they can operate or make arrests.
And the connection to the Louisiana State Penitentiary Angola adds a horrific and calculated psychological deterrent to this operation.
It's a deliberate choice of location designed to maximize fear. Louisiana Governor Jeff Landry offered Angola, which is notorious for its brutal history and is situated on a former slave plantation, to house detainees. Reports suggest DHS Secretary Kristi Noem selected the site specifically for its notoriety, explicitly aiming to use its terrifying reputation as a psychological weapon to induce self-deportation.
The chilling effect on the community is already taking hold even before the operation begins.
Advocacy groups are reporting that schools and after-school programs have already seen big drops in attendance. Immigrant families are retreating into the shadows, limiting contact with essential services. Advocates describe it as a self-imposed state of siege on the population.
Finally, we saw the sanctuary city siege escalate in New York City, targeting both enforcement and activism.
Borders are Tom home and explicitly threatened to flood the zone in New York with federal agents to increase the enforcement presence. And they're matching that aggressive rhetoric with tactical maneuvers. For example, The Guardian revealed on Friday that the FBI has been actively spying on New York immigration activists by infiltrating Signal group chats.
The chats they use to monitor ICE activity at courthouses.
The very same ones. That revelation dangerously blurs the line between legitimate counterterrorism surveillance and aggressive civil immigration enforcement,
yeah,
targeting advocacy groups that are protected by the First Amendment.
It creates a tremendous chilling effect on organizing.
It does. And on top of that, the federal government is reportedly considering reactivating a decommissioned Coast Guard facility on Staten Island to detain arrestees. This is the strategic move to bypass New York City's longstanding refusal to use its own jails for civil immigration detention. They're creating federal detention sites outside of local political control.
Let's move now from these aggressive executive actions to the high-stakes friction between the executive, legislative, and judicial branches. We start with the Supreme Court's decisive but very tactical intervention in the Texas redistricting battle.
Justice Samuel Alito granted an administrative stay in Abbott v. League of United Latin American Citizens, or LULAC. This temporarily restored Texas's 2025 congressional map.
Let's quickly review the background for everyone. A lower federal court had ruled the 2025 map was an illegal racial gerrymander. It violated the Voting Rights Act by diluting Black and Hispanic voting power.
Right, and it ordered the state to revert to the 2021 map for the 2026 elections.
So what was Alito's rationale for the stay?
Alito's administrative stay relies on the Purcell principle, a doctrine that discourages federal courts from changing state election rules too close to an election. In this case, candidate filing had already opened for the 2026 cycle.
But the strategic implication is profound.
It is. The stay makes it highly probable that the discriminatory 2025 map will be the one used for the 2026 midterms. It preserves the structural Republican advantage that the lower court had tried to eliminate. The timing benefits the party in power.
And simultaneously, in D.C., a district judge issued a ruling on the militarization of the Capitol, but then immediately undercut the impact of her own decision.
U.S. District Judge Gia Cogg ruled in Washington v. Trump that the president's deployment of National Guard troops to D.C. for crime deterrence was unlawful. She found it lacked statutory authority under the Insurrection Act. But then she immediately stayed her own ruling until December 11th.
So she declared the action illegal, but then issued a delay, effectively allowing the military presence to remain for several more weeks.
Exactly. This legal paradox lets the administration maintain the visual and physical militarization of the Capitol during a sensitive political time while delaying the judicial impact of her ruling.
The day also saw a terrifying escalation in political rhetoric directed explicitly at members of Congress from the president.
This was deeply concerning. The president used social media to accuse six Democratic military veterans in Congress, including Senators Kelly and Slotkin, of seditious behavior punishable by death.
And this followed a video these lawmakers released urging military personnel to defy illegal orders, an obvious reference to potential mass deportation operations.
The reaction was immediate. The lawmakers reported a massive, instantaneous surge in direct threats, and Capitol Police had to place them on 24/7 security detail. Senator Chris Murphy called the rhetoric a line in the sand, arguing that invoking the death penalty for political speech against elected officials fundamentally threatens the separation of powers.
On the legislative side, the House successfully executed a purely political tactic designed to fracture the opposition party.
Yes, the House passed H-Con Res 58, a resolution denouncing the horrors of socialism, by a vote of 285-98. Now, this is a symbolic resolution. It carries no legal weight, but it was a masterful political move.
Because it was designed to create internal division, and the voting split confirms that.
It completely fractured the opposition. You had 219 Republicans vote yay, and they were joined by 66 Democrats. But 98 Democrats voted nay, successfully highlighting the ideological divisions within the opposition party, especially in the wake of that surprising socialist mayoral win in New York City, which we'll get to.
And finally, a new legal battle emerged between the federal government and its unions, this time targeting the Bureau of Prisons.
The American Federation of Government Employees Council of Prisons Locals 33 filed a new lawsuit against the Bureau of Prisons over the agency's unilateral cancellation of their collective bargaining agreement, their CBA.
So what is the union's central argument here?
The union alleges that the BOP director's cancellation in September was purely a form of retaliation against the union, which violates the First Amendment, and that they failed to follow required procedures, violating the Administrative Procedure Act. Crucially, the BOP announcement made no direct mention of national security, which distinguishes this action from the administration's broader use of executive orders against other federal unions.
And what's been the impact on BOP staff since the agreement was canceled?
Union officials report problems surfacing almost immediately. Mainly, they're unable to represent employees effectively in harassment or disciplinary disputes. The CBA was supposed to run until 2029, and it covered key policies on overtime, sick leave, procedural protections during RIFs, all critical elements of employee welfare that are now just gone.
Let's transition now to international relations and the environment. We saw the United States intentionally create a diplomatic vacuum at the Global Climate Summit.
The U.S. sent no official federal delegation to the COP30 Climate Summit in Belém, Brazil. That's for the first time in the summit's history. It was a deliberate act of disengagement from the global effort.
And what was the measurable result of that diplomatic vacuum on the negotiations?
It severely weakened the political momentum for ambitious action. The negotiations just floundered. The draft text ultimately failed to include a firm, binding roadmap for phasing out fossil fuels. This contributed directly to a near collapse of the talks.
So without U.S. pressure, the leverage was gone.
The leverage to counter petrostates pushing back against that transition language was simply lost.
However, we did see a strong statement of subnational resistance trying to mitigate the damage.
Yeah, the America's All-In delegation, led by figures like former EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy and Mayor Kate Gallego, was there. They operated a kind of parallel foreign policy, representing the commitment of U.S. states, cities, and businesses still dedicated to climate goals.
But they lack the authority to make binding national commitments,
which limits their effectiveness. They can't negotiate finance packages or participate in trade discussions.
And while ignoring the global talks, the administration moved aggressively on domestic energy expansion and deregulation.
The Department of the Interior announced sweeping plans to open nearly 1.3 billion acres of U.S. waters off the coasts of California, Florida, and Alaska to new oil and gas drilling.
That's a dramatic reversal. It shatters decades of bipartisan consensus on protecting those areas.
It does. And at the same time, regulatory changes are being implemented to facilitate this extraction by weakening environmental protections. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service proposed new rules to significantly narrow the definition of effects of the action under the Endangered Species Act.
Which is a regulatory sleight of hand.
It is. It aims to deregulate major infrastructure and extraction projects by making it legally much harder for environmental groups to block them based on potential indirect harm to protected species. It shifts the burden of proof and the scope of environmental review.
Okay, let's turn inward now and focus on economic matters, specifically the financial health of the federal workforce, particularly after that record-breaking government shutdown.
The shutdown caused immense economic instability and mental health fallout, and we're just now getting concrete data on how support institutions responded.
FedChoice Federal Credit Union reported welcoming a lot of new members and providing substantial direct support during the crisis.
They reported assisting hundreds of federal workers. By allowing nearly 350 members to skip loan payments, they preserved almost $150,000 in immediate cash flow for those households. In total, FedChoice delivered $2.4 million in direct financial aid.
But they recognized the crisis went beyond just dollars and cents. They took a more holistic approach.
Precisely. They organized food truck events and crucially connected employees with mental health professionals and certified financial planners. They recognized the trauma of financial instability. The CEO of Transcend Clinical Services, Alexis Jones, offered three tangible suggestions for resilience.
Which were?
Controlled controllables, focus on what you can influence. Get outside and move your body to break the stress cycle. And be intentional about what negative information you allow into your awareness.
Good advice. Let's look forward now to year-end tax and retirement planning insights that were discussed on Friday, particularly for federal employees. The deadline for maximizing 2025 TSP contributions is critical.
It is. Employees really need to maximize their 2025 TSP contributions. That's capped at $23,000, plus an additional $7,500 for the catch-up contribution if you're over 50.
So if you've fallen behind, the advice is to adjust your pay periods now.
Adjust them now to make sure you max out those pre-tax or Roth buckets before December 31st.
But the major change that's looming for 2026, it's a massive compliance detail for higher earners, and it requires planning to start today.
This is a huge game-changing detail for 26. The TSP regulation is changing. Federal employees aged 50 and older who earn $145,000 or more will no longer be allowed to make that $7,500 catch-up contribution pre-tax. They will be mandated to use Roth contributions for that portion.
Meaning they pay the tax on the catch-up contribution up front, which increases their taxable income in 2026. And this isn't optional for them.
It is mandatory for that income bracket. It fundamentally alters the tax calculation for higher-earning older federal employees. They need to factor in that immediate tax burden and adjust their total tax withholding now. It requires immediate consultation with a financial planner to avoid a surprise tax bill next year.
In terms of financial hardship, the advice was clear. Borrowing from your TSP is often better than high-interest consumer debt.
Well, absolutely. The TSP offers loans of up to $50,000. The benefit is crucial. First, the interest rate you pay on the loan is paid back to yourself directly into your own TSP account.
Not to a bank.
Not to a bank. And second, the process forces financial discipline as repayments start immediately. It's a low-cost lifeline to avoid spiraling into 20 or 30% interest credit card debt.
We also saw advice on year-end tax strategies for non-retirement brokerage accounts, particularly tax loss harvesting.
For anyone who holds investment assets outside of their retirement accounts, tax loss harvesting is a smart move right now. By selling losing positions, you generate a realized loss. You can use that loss to offset any capital gains you had or, critically, reduce up to $3,000 of your ordinary taxable salary income.
And that reduction of ordinary income, the highest taxed income, translates into significant immediate tax savings. But there's a crucial catch, which needs a clear explanation. The wash sale rule.
This is the non-negotiable detail. The wash sale rule prohibits you from claiming a loss if you buy the substantially identical security within 30 days before or after the date you sold the losing position. If you violate this 61-day window, the IRS disallows the loss.
So you have to wait 31 days to repurchase it.
Or buy something similar but not identical right away.
And finally, for those 70 and a half and older thinking about charitable giving.
This is where qualified charitable distributions, QCDs, come in. If you're 70 and a half or older, you can transfer funds directly from an IRA, and only an IRA, not a TSP, to a qualified charity. This distribution satisfies your required minimum distribution, your RMD, without the distribution ever being taxed as income.
So it's highly tax efficient.
It's one of the most effective ways for retirees to give and manage their required withdrawals at the same time.
Finally, a quick reminder on flexible spending accounts.
The year-end deadline is looming. FSAs are critical for tax-free healthcare expenses, with the family max usually around $2,000 to $3,000. Crucially, FSA money is typically use it or lose it. If the funds aren't used by year-end, they're forfeited. So you need to be intentional about using those funds now.
Let's pivot now to specific enforcement and regulatory headwinds that emerged on Friday, starting with the chilling effect of a Supreme Court ruling on animal welfare enforcement.
This is a prime example of how a ruling in one highly specialized area, in this case, securities law, can create chaos across completely unrelated agencies. The problem comes from the Supreme Court case SEC v. Jarkissi, which was decided in June of 2024.
Right.
And even though it was a securities fraud case, it has effectively frozen Animal Welfare Act enforcement across thousands of research labs.
So we need to connect those dots. Why does a securities case stop animal welfare fines?
It's highly technical, so let's be clear. The Jarkissi ruling challenged the SEC's use of its internal administrative court system. The court found that a party accused of fraud, if they're facing a fine, is entitled to a jury trial under the Seventh Amendment.
Okay.
The USDA also uses its own internal administrative courts to levy fines against research facilities that violate the Animal Welfare Act. These facilities only register with the USDA. They aren't fully licensed. So fines are the USDA's primary and most effective enforcement tool.
So now the USDA is afraid to use its own courts.
They're paralyzed. They're hesitant to issue fines for AWA violations because they fear the labs will immediately challenge the fine on Jarkissi grounds, leading to years of litigation and probably a judicial reversal.
And the data on this enforcement collapse is shocking.
It is stark proof of the chilling effect. In the 14 months before the Jarkissi decision, USDA AFEI issued 63 Animal Welfare Act fines. And the 14 months after the decision, they issued just five.
Just five.
A 90% drop. It suggests the USDA's primary means of accountability has just been sidelined by a seemingly unrelated Supreme Court ruling.
And this paralysis is compounded by a severe systemic inspector shortage.
The situation is unsustainable.
Wow.
A 2025 report cited only 77 inspectors available for approximately 17,500 licensees and registrants nationwide.
So each inspector is averaging 227 facilities.
The result: in 2024, approximately 45% of facilities were not inspected at all. Without inspections or the ability to issue fines, the AWA becomes effectively unenforceable.
So the Animal Welfare Institute is pushing legislative fixes.
They are. They're promoting several bills. The Animal Welfare Enforcement Improvement Act to strengthen licensing. The Better Care for Animals Act to mandate collaboration between USDA and the DOJ to bypass the administrative courts. And Goldie's Act, which would require USDA to give inspection reports showing violations to local law enforcement within 24 hours.
Shifting now to Department of Justice prosecution, we saw a clear example of the administration's populist enforcement streak.
Yes, Attorney General Pamela Bondi's DOJ secured a significant victory on Friday. They got a 40-month prison sentence for a healthcare executive named Eduardo Lopez for conspiring to fix the wages of nurses in Las Vegas.
This action highlights a fascinating duality in the administration's strategy.
It really does. While the administration targets public sector unions for dismantling and aggressively deregulates environmental protections, it simultaneously goes after private sector wage-fixing cartels and white-collar crime that hurts workers.
It's a dual approach.
It's designed to appeal to a populist anti-elite narrative. They're dismantling the deep state bureaucracy on one hand, while appealing to the working class by punishing corporate malfeasance on the other. It's a political tightrope act.
And now for the biggest political plot twist and headline of the day, the shocking meeting in the Oval Office between the president and New York City mayor-elect Zohran Mamdani.
This meeting was extraordinary on every level. It marked a profound and sudden shift from months of extreme public hostility. The president had called the Democratic Socialist mayor-elect a communist.
And Mamdani had called the president a fascist.
And yet, there they were, shaking hands in the Oval Office.
And they didn't focus on ideology or past insults. They focused on populist bread-and-butter concerns.
The conversation focused almost exclusively on the immediate cost of living issues in New York City. Affordability, housing, groceries, utilities. The exchanges were surprisingly warm, almost chummy. The president stated he would feel comfortable living in New York City under a Mamdani administration, saying, "We agree on a lot more than I would have thought."
That sentiment seems to be underpinned by a realization of a shared populist base.
Absolutely. The president explicitly related Mamdani's base of support to his own, citing the support he got from former Bernie Sanders voters, who he said were strong on trade and were tired of being ripped off.
So the meeting was a calculated move.
It was exploring an axis of political agreement based on anti-establishment populism that transcends the traditional left-right ideology.
And the president even threw a key Republican ally under the bus to facilitate this new working relationship.
When he was asked about Republican strategist Elise Stefanik having called Mamdani a jihadist during the campaign, the president just dismissed it, saying, "You say things sometimes in a campaign."
Wow.
It was a clear, calculated choice to prioritize a working relationship with the incoming mayor and the positive press it generated over supporting a key ally like Stefanik. It was transactional politics at its most transparent.
And the timing of the meeting, happening just as the House was condemning socialism, was handled with real political savvy by the mayor-elect.
When Mamdani was asked about that resolution passing on the very same day, he responded simply that he focused very little on resolutions and was instead focused on the immediate work at hand.
Delivering affordability for New Yorkers.
Right. Both men emerged looking like pragmatists focused on immediate results over ideological warfare. It's a powerful contrast. The president even revealed a personal ambition. "One of the things I would have loved to be someday is the mayor of New York City."
Reflecting on this comprehensive report of a single day, the intensity is just overwhelming. In one 24-hour window, the administration initiated the functional destruction of a cabinet department, escalated interior immigration enforcement to unprecedented levels, and secured critical judicial interventions that benefit their political machine for the next election.
The day clearly demonstrates that the administration has mastered the use of executive, administrative, and enforcement tools to bypass a potentially uncooperative Congress and drive ideological change through structural shifts. They are prioritizing these high-visibility, politically charged actions that appeal directly to their base.
But that laser focus on structural and political warfare, it overshadows a massive, looming fiscal crisis that will impact millions of families financially, regardless of their political affiliation.
And that is the ultimate crucial test of Congress's capability moving forward. House Minority Leader Jeffries warned on Friday that the expiration of the ACA premium tax credits is set for December 31st.
If Congress fails to act to renew them,
this will result in premium hikes of $1,000 to $2,000 per month for millions of Americans who rely on those subsidies to afford health insurance.
This is a crisis that directly hits the cost of living and household budgets far more than any administrative agreement or symbolic House resolution.
Precisely. Given the volume of politically charged administrative and legal battles dominating Washington's attention right now, from immigration sweeps to department dismantling, we leave you to ponder. Is Congress capable of putting aside the ideological warfare and tackling this looming financial deadline before year-end? Or will this administrative whirlwind completely overshadow a crucial crisis that will directly and painfully impact the cost of living for millions of working families? Something to consider as you process this intense 24-hour period.